Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org.
Are these people in your carpool?
This is Jeff Bosser.
Hello, I'm Renee Montaigne.
This is AM 580 News Director Tom Rogers. Beep, beep, beep,
beep, yeah. Whether you're coming or going, you depend on us to keep you informed. We depend on you for financial support to make that possible. Give to our member match fund today, and we'll use your dollars on April 15th to challenge others to help make great programs possible on WILL. Go to willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose initiative on immigration, history, and policy presents Global Economic Change and Migration of Asian Women, What Are the Issues? By Gene Pyle on Monday, April 6th at noon at the Center for Advanced Study, 912 West Illinois in Urbana.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. When he disappeared in the Amazon jungle in 1925, Colonel Perry Fawcett was looking for a lost city, home to an ancient and sophisticated civilization, a city that was, as he had been told by the Indians, enormously rich in gold, so much so as to blaze like fire. He was a man obsessed. Who was Fawcett? At the time of his disappearance, the British adventurer was known around the world. Journalist David Graham describes him as the last of the great Victorian explorers who ventured into uncharted realms with little more than a machete, a compass, and an almost divine sense of purpose. When Graham, a staff writer for The New Yorker, stumbled upon a reference to Fawcett 5 years ago, it was the beginning of his obsession with Fawcett, Fawcett's disappearance, the jungle, and the lost city. David Grand's search for Fawcett took him into the Amazon. Grand tells the story in the book, The Lost City of Z, a tale of deadly obsession in the Amazon. David Grand is our guest in this portion of the program today. David Grand's book, The Lost City of Z, is published by Doubleday. David Grand, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What a rip-roaring good story.
It's a crazy story.
Yeah. Well, how was it that you stumbled across the reference to Fawcett?
Yeah, I was doing another story for The New Yorker several years ago on the death of a leading Conan Doyle scholar. And in the course of researching that story, I came upon a reference that Fawcett, this British explorer, had helped inspire Conan Doyle's novel, The Lost World. And at that point, I had read The Lost World, and I was curious. I had not heard of Fawcett, and I had plugged Fawcett's name into a historical database, and up had come all these kind of crazy headlines. Fawcett party vanishes into the unknown, another Fawcett search party disappears. And these weren't these little stories. These were banner headlines across the New York Times, the LA Times, and newspapers around the world. And at that point, it really began to pique my interest, and I began to look into the story.
Yeah. You like to work on stories that, in your words, put you in the grip.
Yes.
So how soon were you in the grip of this story?
Well, I never always know when I'm in the grip until it's probably too late. So in this case, I was probably in the grip pretty early on because I began to travel around the world, going through archives, trying to dig up Fawcett's papers and letters. But I probably didn't realize I was fully in the grip until I was lost in the middle of the jungle trying to chase on Fawcett's trail.
Yeah. Your wife, who is also a journalist, asked you some good questions when
yes,
you told...
Yes, she does. She's my sensible partner.
When you told her you were going to the Amazon to try to find out what might have happened to Fawcett, she said, you told her, well, it's not like I'll be the first to go. Hundreds of others have done it. And then she asked you a very good question. And what happened to them? And you had to tell her many of them disappeared.
Yeah, she gave me that. There was a kind of a long pause, and she gave me the look, which I know do well. And the funny part was she said, and, you know, I kind of explained I was looking for this explorer. And like many people, they think, well, okay, you know, they disappeared a few years ago. And then I kind of explained it was about 80 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked at me, and then she asked what had happened to these explorers. And I had to explain that many people, you know, had in fact tried to solve this mystery, the mystery about what had happened to Fawcett. And there's really kind of two mysteries in this story. There was the mystery of Fawcett and his party, who in 1925 had ventured into Amazon looking for this ancient civilization, which he had called Z, and disappeared. So there was a mystery of what happened to them. And then there was the mystery of this ancient city. Did it really exist, or was it a figment of the imagination? And both mysteries really compelled me. But when my wife asked me about all these, what had happened to all these other parties who had tried to solve the mystery, I had to explain that many of them had died of starvation and disease, and a lot of them had disappeared. And then she looked at me and she said, I sure hope you know what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, at the outset of your journey, you spoke with two men who went in search of Fawcett and lived to tell the tale.
Right. I mean, one of the things that was so interesting to me was that this mystery had compelled people, not only in the 20s and 30s and 40s, who for decades had searched for Fawcett, but that this compulsion with this mystery had continued all the way into the present. And in 1996, a large Brazilian expedition went, and it was a father and a son, which seems to be a strange reoccurring theme in the book. A father took his son with him, and they went into the wilderness, and they were kidnapped by a tribe and held in captivity.
And the son told you, you know, I had a lot of romantic notions about the jungle, and this kind of finished that.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things that I encountered in reading many of the diaries, Fawcett, of the companions who had gone with Fawcett, before he disappeared in 1925, he began exploring the Amazon in 1906, and he explored the wilderness for nearly two decades. And I had tracked down many of the diaries of his companions, and like that son, they all begin with kind of great romance about their journeys. Mm-hmm. There was one naturalist who went with Fawcett in 1921. He had great hopes of becoming the next Darwin. And yet, when you read his diaries, it goes further along in the journey. He's slowly driven mad by the bugs and disease and hunger. And over time, his diary just becomes more and more delirious until all he's cataloging are the bugs that are attacking him.
Mm-hmm. And a little bit later after that conversation that you had with James Lynch and his son James Jr., you went looking for a guide, and a guide told you you were out of your mind.
Yeah, finding a guide wasn't the easiest problem in the world. When I called around looking for many guides, they would say they were muito ocupado, meaning, which seemed to mean they basically I was out of my mind.
Yeah,
and nobody wanted to do it. But I did eventually find somebody, Paulo Pinochet, who was a professional samba dancer. But he had once worked for FUNAI, a government agency set up to protect the indigenous communities, and he could help make contact with these tribes, because we were heading where Fawcett disappeared is an area of the southern basin of the Amazon, which is still under tribal control.
Yeah. Well, all these tales of disappearance and death and hardship, and then contemporary folks saying essentially to you, I'd turn back if I were you. Did you ever hesitate or have second thoughts?
You know, I mean, one of the things I try to explore in the book is the nature of obsession and how it can kind of grip you. And I was very focused on the mechanics. I was less focused on the mechanics of my trip than on its object. And so I was so focused on trying to kind of figure out this mystery. I had uncovered a bunch of clues that other people hadn't found that indicated where Fawcett had really gone, mm-hmm. and on this ancient city. And I just kept thinking, well, if I go here, I can solve this and find the final pieces to this puzzle. And so I didn't dwell on it so much. It was really once I was in the jungle, and there was a period when I was lost, and it was at that point that I spoke with my wife through on a satellite phone, and it was at that point that I really kind of dwelled on the consequences of some of these decisions we make, and in the case of Fawcett, it proved to really be lethal. He in his own obsession, didn't just disappear looking for the city, but he had brought his oldest son with him, Jack, who he adored, and who his son really adored his father.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to be spoilers here this afternoon, because I suspect that there are people listening who would like to read this book or who may be reading it now. But there's plenty of things to talk about without revealing too much. So let's not do that.
Okay.
But let's talk about some of the background of this story. When did stories of Z or El Dorado first begin to show up?
You know, right from the very beginning, when the first conquistadors had arrived in South America, they had heard stories from the Indians that the Amazonian wilderness, which is an area about the size of the United States, had contained this great, glorious civilization that they called El Dorado. And it was named El Dorado because the Indians said that the place was so plentiful in gold that the inhabitants ground the metal into powder and blew it through hollow canes upon their naked bodies. And in 1542, the first expedition in search of El Dorado set out, and they took about some 4,000 men. And on that expedition alone, some 4,000 men died of disease and starvation and from tribes defending their territory with arrows dipped in poison. And really, for the next three centuries, expeditions would go looking for this ancient city, and they all ended in disaster. Many of them died. Sometimes they descended into cannibalism, eating their own because they were starving. Others were driven mad. And so this notion had really haunted the Western imagination for centuries, from the first very early days that the Europeans arrived in the Americas.
Mm-hmm. What did Fawcett think of the indigenous peoples of the Amazon?
You know, Fawcett was interesting because he grew up in the Victorian era, and he was instilled and taught many of the racist attitudes of that time period that really looked upon the inhabitants of the Amazon or Native Americans in general in very racist terms. And yet when he was in the jungle and he encountered these tribes, he was always very respectful and deferential. He refused to let his men fire on the Indians under any circumstances, even if the expedition was being ambushed. And so he was always wrestling with kind of what he saw. He was always very impressed by the tribes, and impressed by the sophisticated nature of many of their civilizations and their cultures. And so he was always kind of, he on one side of his brain, he had everything he was taught, and then he had everything he kind of saw. And these two were always at battle within him. But for his time period, he was remarkably progressive in his treatment of the Indians.
Mm. In recent years, you report, many peoples of the Amazon have become politically organized, and as a result, the Brazilian government has policies designed to protect them. What's the situation today for Native peoples in the Amazon?
Well, it's a very mixed picture. I mean, in some ways, a lot of the tribes have been extremely resilient and have organized themselves or have defended their territory fiercely and have been able to preserve their culture and way of life. And even some of their populations are beginning to grow after years of decimation by disease. But a lot of these tribal areas are constantly under assault from prospectors and loggers who try to take the land and often bring with them disease. So it's a fight that's still going on, and the tribes that have survived have been incredibly resilient and ingenious. But it's, you know, there are along with the successes, there are still many tragedies.
Yeah. Here in this part of the country, we grow a lot of corn and soybeans, and also in Brazil, in the areas of Mato Grosso and Pará, corn and soybeans are grown. We hear weather reports on growing conditions in that part of the world because so many people are interested in the market for the crops. What did you see on the ground in Brazil, and Is there more and more agriculture springing up in this part of the world?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things was I had Fawcett's letters from his final expedition. Fawcett had, as he went into the jungle in 1925, had written dispatches and letters which were then carried out of the jungle by Indian runners. He would give them to Indians. They would carry them out of the jungle, describing his ordeal. And I had these letters with me, and they were describing, and I followed Fawcett's path precisely. And Fawcett, I'd be reading his letters when I stood in the same spot as he described hacking through jungle, and the jungle was so intense that he got separated from his son at one point. And in these parts, some of these parts, I would look out, and there was nothing there. All the jungle had been deforested, and it literally looked like Nebraska. And soybean farms had been developed there, or were about to be developed there, and all you could see were the burnt stumps from trees. And so in these areas, as I moved deeper, I went deeper into the wilderness. But early in my journey, it was amazing to see how much of this wilderness area has been transformed.
Mm. What were your first impressions when you were really in there?
Well, you know, it's the amazing thing is you kind of bring things with you that you think will make things easier, and they do to some extent. You have your shots and your immunities, and I brought a GPS, and so you have things that Fawcett could never imagine, and yet once you're kind of dense in the wilderness, it's amazing how similar the conditions then become to what Fawcett had experienced. And if you're to an untutored eye, and this is what always happens to people who are new to the jungle, what kind of happened to those early El Dorado expeditions, if you're not accustomed to this natural battlefield, and unlike the tribes that have lived there for so long and have adapted to the conditions, you're quickly and easily overwhelmed and outmatched by what you confront.
How far did you travel? How long were you there?
Well, the trip was a couple months, and I was in probably the denser part of the wilderness for about 5 weeks.
Hmm. I'm thinking right now of the 1914 trip of Fawcett when he was in for 3 months.
Yeah, well, Fawcett would go in. I mean, the thing about Fawcett in his earlier trips, where he would sometimes go, he would go for months. He would sometimes go for a year or even up to 2 years. And he would take these parties in of about a dozen men. He, unlike most Amazon explorers and expeditions, he didn't believe in taking large parties. He really believed in taking small parties. He believed it was the only way to establish peaceful contact with the Amazonian tribes. And he would take these small parties in for, you know, like I said, months and months at a time, and usually half his men would die of disease or starvation.
Hmm. He kept going back.
He kept going back, and, you know, I think it was complicated what motivated him. On one level, he was, I think, fleeing, like many explorers, especially in the Victorian age of exploration, or the Edwardian age of exploration. The constraints of his society. I think there was something about being away from it that always drew him. And in fact, by the end of his life, he really lived very much like an Indian warrior in the jungle. He used to paint his face, and even when he came back to Europe, he couldn't sleep in his bed. He would string a hammock. He then also fought in World War I, and he was at the Battle of the Somme, and it was just an incredibly a bloody battle in which thousands and thousands of people died, and he watched all these young kids basically march out of the trenches and into machine gun fire.
Mm.
And that really, for him, represented a collapse in many ways of Western civilization. And I think the notion then of this place that he called this ancient civilization that he called Z, grew in his mind and took on kind of more fantastical proportions, and I think he was very much drawn to the possibility of finding some place, some other, some counterpoint to what he had seen.
Why did he believe in the lost city, a city enormously rich in gold?
Yeah. I mean, Fawcett was interesting because he was an amateur, as the profession of anthropology and archaeology was at its very inception. And so he was still an amateur, but he had been trained in the scientific method, and he really early on really pieced his theory together fairly meticulously. finding clues. For example, when he was marching through the jungles, once he was in the Bolivian floodplains of the Amazon, and he climbed this large earth mound, and he saw something sticking out of the ground, and he dug it up, and it was a shard of pottery. And he began to dig everywhere, and he found other shards of pottery. And this was before carbon dating, so he couldn't pinpoint its age, but it looked very ancient to him. And then when he looked out, he saw other earth mounds, these kind of large, you know, big, huge mounds. And connecting them, he could almost swear underneath the growth of the forest looked to be causeways or roads. And so he was collecting evidence from his experiences like that, also interviewing many of the tribes he met and stayed with, and gathering clues. And he also studied some of the early El Dorado hunters and their early trips and took clues from their chronicles. So there were various things that he put together and pieced together his theory on.
Hmm. Are Fawcett's records, are they of value to archaeologists today?
Well, I mean, the thing about Fawcett was for many years, after all these El Dorado expeditions ended in failure, most people had concluded that El Dorado was no more than a delusion. And Fawcett, for most of the 20th century, was really dismissed by the scientific community as a crank who had sacrificed not just his life but the life of his son in pursuit of a mad fantasy. And it was generally assumed that the Amazon was really a counterfeit paradise, a place that despite its flora and fauna was really inimical to human life, that the conditions were simply too brutal, and that the soil was too depleted of nutrients to allow enough agriculture to support a large population. And so it was seen as a place that couldn't really have a complex society. But in recent years, archaeologists are now beginning to challenge that theory and are reevaluating many of the things that Fawcett had claimed. And so they are now, Fawcett in many ways is being proven more prescient.
Hmm. And the stories that have come down over time orally among people in the Amazon, are they useful? Are they being paid more attention to?
Yeah, I think for the first time, a lot of, for so long, because of the assumptions about the jungle as being this kind of counterfeit paradise, and most people dismissed a lot of these early theories or even oral legends, and they're now being reevaluated. For example, one of the things Fawcett did was he had studied the first El Dorado hunters who had gone into the Amazon. And even though they had never found this glorious golden kingdom, they had all described seeing large settlements with large populations, cities that glistened with white, great roads and causeways and bridges. Now, later, explorers who went in didn't see those things, and so they assumed that the conquistadors had simply embellished their tales to placate the king or the queen who had sponsored their disastrous journeys. Mm. So these accounts were always dismissed and ignored, but Fawcett actually studied them, and he looked at these descriptions of these early settlements to help piece together his theory. And now archaeologists are reevaluating and looking back at these texts that they had once dismissed and finding that they may have been much more than a fable. Mm.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, David Gran. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, a contributing editor for The New Republic. He's written for that publication and others, including The New York Times Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post. His book, The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon, is published by Doubleday. Were there rivalries between explorers?
Yeah, there really was. I mean, one of the things is you kind of imagine that there's going to be this nice kind of fraternity of men, but they all had very titanic egos. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, for example, had explored the Amazon around this period in around 1913, 1914, and had gone down the River of Doubt and discovered this tributary. Mm-hmm. And they were all extremely competitive, and Fawcett had won chief rival, a man named Alexander Hamilton Rice, who was one of the wealthiest men in America. And what was interesting is that they were both looking for an ancient civilization, this kind of El Dorado-like place in the Amazon. And Alexander Hamilton Rice, because he had so much money, would take these extraordinarily elaborate expeditions with all the newest technology. In fact, he was one of the first to ever bring a early wireless radio into the Amazon. And Fawcett had almost no money and was competing with rice and would take these really bare-bone expeditions. So you have, almost at the same time, you have this kind of the first really modern expedition going and then an expedition that was really of the previous century.
How successful was rice?
Well, rice never, he found some clues as well. In fact, he uncovered evidence of petroglyphs. But one of the things that Rice did that horrified Fawcett and is very disconcerting to me during my research was that he had once, on one famous encounter, he had been surrounded by a tribe and he had his men, they opened fire on them and massacred many Indians, something that Fawcett was extremely appalled by. And Fawcett always had a strict policy of not firing under the on the natives under any circumstances. So, so in that respect, he was a failure, and with some serious consequences. Some of his expeditions, though, were successful in terms of finding. Hamilton Rice was trained as a doctor, and in terms of finding, medical cures and looking at plants for possibly medicinal cures. And he also took some of the first modern expeditions. So he would bring a lot with him, various kind of people of different professions. You know, he'd bring with him an anthropologist and a biologist or a botanist. And some of their studies proved successful and did have, bore fruit.
Yeah. Was Fawcett also interested in natural history?
He was. I mean, Fawcett was kind of a dilettante in that sense of the way many of the Victorians were, and he kind of had a kind of wide-ranging curiosity. He was almost all self-taught in almost every fashion, but he had an interest. He was an engineer. He was also a very talented artist. So his interest was pretty wide in terms of the things he studied and looked at when he would go into the Amazon.
Hmm. What was his background? What was his education?
He was interesting. His father was part of the upper class and part of the aristocracy in England. In fact, was very close to the future king, but had squandered all the family's wealth, and he was an alcoholic. And so Fawcett kind of grew up poor, though they tried to kind of carry out the pretense that they still had money. And he was sent to the military academy at Woolwich in England, which was pretty tough early training. The conditions were pretty tough. They really hardened you. And he then later went to train at the Royal Geographical Society in London. He had grown up during the Victorian Age of Exploration. He had grown up kind of worshipping figures like Burton and Speke and Livingstone. And so he had gone to the Royal Geographical Society, which was almost like a finishing school for explorers. So he was trained there. And I read many of the manuals that Fawcett had been given to learn how to survive in the wilderness. And they kind of gave me a sense of how primitive their training was in terms of science and medicine. For example, they would say things like, if you're in the wilderness and you get bitten by a poisonous snake, to take your gunpowder, pack it into the wound, and ignite it. Or if you're hit by a poisonous arrow, to take boiling grease and pour it into the wound to help it cauterize. So you got a sense in reading these things, kind of what these men would face when they were suddenly sent out. And after the Royal training at the Royal Geographical Society, Fawcett was actually recruited as a spy, which was fairly common back then. The British Empire liked to use map makers and surveyors as spies because it was the perfect cover. They were supposed to be going into these places anyways and nosing around, and so they would use map makers and surveyors like Fawcett to go in covertly and serve as secret agents. And Fawcett did that for a period, and then after that period, he then began his explorations in the Amazon.
Mm. When did he become a celebrity?
Pretty early on, by the early kind of, his first expedition in the Amazon was 1906, and really by about 1908 or 1909, stories of his adventures began to captivate the public's imagination, especially, how he would survive in the wilderness for years without contact, and stories of how he would battle piranha or electric eels or anaconda, and then how he would always emerge with maps from regions which no expeditions had come back from. And one of the things that kind of fueled his legend was he would take these parties and so many of his men would die and he would always survive. And it helped contribute to the sense of his invincibility that he himself shared and that his own family shared about him. And in many ways, that made it inexplicable when he later disappeared. People couldn't quite wrap their minds around the possibility that this man who seemed so indestructible had possibly died.
Yeah. Can you tell us something of his wife?
His wife, Nina, who is one of the more interesting characters in the book, you know, she grew up in this Victorian era, and where her role was always subjugated to her husband's. It was always secondary, and she clearly, when you read her letters, had longings to be an explorer herself, took great interest in her husband's expeditions, and had even taught herself how to survey. And when Fawcett was training at the Royal Geographic Society, she would often help him with his preparations. And she really, even though she could never go herself on these expeditions, she really became his partner in many ways and invested all her energy in his success. And that often had a huge price for her because Fawcett would invest what little money he had on his expeditions and in looking for this ancient city. And so she lived a really difficult life. I mean, by the end, they were living in this house with no, you know, without running water and no electricity, and they were essentially bankrupt. And but she had always saw herself almost tied up with his enterprise, and in the end, did something that was somewhat shocking in that she agreed and went along with Fawcett's decision to take his oldest son, Jack, on that final expedition in 1925, where they disappeared.
Hmm. What kind of a young man was Jack?
Jack was very dashing. He looked like a movie star, and in fact, he had aspirations to become one when he returned as a famed explorer. And he really worshipped his father, and his father really saw him as the kind of, you know, his little model or doppelganger. Mm-hmm. And but he also had no experience exploring before he set out, and while he did pretty well, according to the letters, it was a highly risky proposition to bring him along.
Yeah.
And interestingly, Lawrence of Arabia, the famed explorer, British explorer, had volunteered at one point to go with Fawcett, but Fawcett had chosen his son instead.
Mm. And also, along with Jack's good friend, Raleigh, is it Rimmel or Rimmel?
It's I always say Rimmel, but it is actually Rimmel.
Oh, okay.
And yes, Jack and Raleigh had grown up together in the countryside of England, and they were best friends. And just as Jack really worshipped his father, Raleigh really looked up to Jack, and the two had really been inseparable. But the conditions in the jungle were so difficult, and when you read the letters from their final expedition, you see how divisions are already beginning within the expedition and even coming between the friends.
Yeah. Well, speaking of letters, the book makes one forget you're tucked safely into an armchair, in part because of the dialogue. And in your author's note, you say anything that appears in the text between quotation marks, including conversation in the jungle from vanished explorers, comes directly from a diary, a letter, or some other written document. How did you come across all these wonderful sources?
Yeah, it was. It took me years to track down a lot of these things. For example, Raleigh's letters home. I had spent years trying to find them. Raleigh had siblings, but none of them had kids, and they hadn't bequeathed any letters to museums. And I spent about more than three years trying everywhere. I would do genealogies and checking every place he lived and writing blind letters to people who I thought might be relatives. In his case, eventually I had tracked down a woman who was a first cousin who was about in her 90s living in England outside of London. And at this point, I didn't expect her to have anything, and I spoke with her, and I said, you know, she said she was related, and I chatted with her, and I said, well, do you have any letters from Raleigh? And she said, oh, I just happened up in my attic to have his last letters home from the expedition that I'd kept. In the case of Fawcett's letters and diaries, I had gone to England, and I tracked down a granddaughter of his in Cardiff, Wales, a lovely woman named Rolette. She had invited me into her house, and we chatted for a while. And at one point, she said to me, well, do you really want to know what happened to my grandfather? And I said, yes, if at all possible. And she had invited, and she led me into a back room, and there was this old chest. And she opened up the old chest. Inside were all these books covered in dust, and the bindings were disintegrating. And I asked her what they were. And she said, well, those are my grandfather's secret diaries and logbooks. And those, for me, if Fawcett's treasure was Z, these were my treasure.
Yeah.
And I really combed them for clues, and they held an amazing clues. Fawcett had been extremely secretive, for example, about where he was going in the jungle to look for Z. Going back to your question, were there rivalries?
Mm-hmm.
Fawcett was so conscious of rivalries that one of his rivalries might beat him to his discovery, that he had been extremely clandestine. In fact, when he wrote letters to his wife, he would often use codes to put in letters when he would write the coordinates of where he was going, and she had a cipher to decode them. And in these diaries and logbooks, they actually had amazing clues to his actual route. And it was really when I found those diaries and these clues that I had said, well, you know what? You know, maybe I'll do something foolish and go into the jungle myself.
How does his surviving family view him?
You know, I still think they look up to him. I mean, I still think he's an heroic figure. One of the things that struck me when I met, for example, with a granddaughter, was that for many people, this is a great mystery. It's often been described as the greatest exploration mystery of the 20th century. And when I began to approach the story, that was kind of what was so tantalizing. When you meet the family, you realize that within every mystery, there's really a personal tragedy. And this tragedy in which a father and a son had disappeared had really haunted the family and really had enormous repercussions to it over the years. Nina never wanted to believe that her husband and son had died to the day she died. The younger son was swept up in this and trying to figure out what had happened to them. And so I got a sense talking to them of how what's a mystery for others is really an extraordinarily deeply impacting tragedy.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist David Gran, author of The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go to line one, a listener in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Just a question or so and a comment, some in the field perhaps, but actually, I kind of wish you would let us know what happened, but I have a guess what the result of his last journey and so forth. But I've recently read a book or part of a book by an anthropologist who studied some of the tribes in the Amazon, and he was amazed by the fact that the Indians seemed to know which plants to use for healing purposes and which plants to use for a variety of purposes. And he makes the point that the Indians ingest this, and I can't pronounce it, ayahuasca, A-Y-U-S-C-H,
mm-hmm.
say, and it's some sort of apparently extremely powerful hallucinogenic plant that from which the Indians then, the native tribes, then realize what plants are valuable for healing and so forth. Did you come across that at all in your researches on this fellow? And I'll just hang up. And oh, one other comment. It sounds to me like this chap that you're talking about, he was almost on a semi-spiritual quest for this city. It sounds it's rather strange, but I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Those are good, really good observations, questions. Yes, I didn't encounter that particular hallucinogenic that you cited in the parts where I went, but I did. Many of the tribes I encountered have learned to use various herbal medicines and poisons extremely effectively. For example, in the Xingu area where I went, the tribes will use a poison which they put into pockets of rivers, and this poison will stun fish. It actually causes the fish, it momentarily paralyzes them, and they essentially just float to the surface, and then they're able to collect them. And then a moment later, the fish that were not collected, that were stunned, go back swimming and are fine and are unharmed. And when they cook the fish, there's no toxins in the fish. So they are amazing. They've, over the years, acquired amazing knowledge of various plants and medicines and poisons and herbs and et cetera. And Fawcett, one of the ways he was able to survive was he adopted many of the methods that the tribes used and became a large believer in these remedies that many of the tribes used for disease, et cetera.
Hmm. Tell us about the man who turned out to be your guide, Paulo Pinochet.
Paulo Pinochet. Paulo, again, it was not easy to find a guide. And Paulo was a lovely guy. Had a great sense of humor, which was important. The funny thing is, when I first met Paulo, before we set out, he looked utterly ragged. He was wearing a vest, and he was sunburned. He looked like burnt as a tomato. And he was bearded and grizzly looking, and he looked as if he had just returned from an expedition rather than setting out on one. But he had also once worked, he was a professional samba dancer, but he had also once worked for FUNAI, this government agency, which mm-hmm. protects the indigenous populations. And it was with him and through him that we were able to make contact with various tribes in the tribal areas where Fawcett had gone. And that's extremely important. The area where Fawcett disappeared is a reservation today. It wasn't in Fawcett's day. And along with an adjoining reservation, it's about the size of Belgium. It's one of the largest swaths of territory in the world today that remains under indigenous control. And because of the bloody history of the contact with settlers, you can't just wander onto these territories. You need somebody who can make contact with the tribal leaders and negotiate, because these areas really function almost as countries within a country.
Yeah, and how were you and Paulo greeted by the people that you came across?
You know, really pretty well. And, you know, sometimes there was some initial difficulty when you're trying to kind of explain your interest and why you want to go on to their area. And again, there's an understandable weariness on their part because of the history. But once I overcame that and they kind of understood my intentions and that I wasn't a prospector and we shared gifts back and forth, they were extremely welcoming and led me into their areas and were incredibly hospitable and let me stay in their houses. And, you know, they have these beautiful houses they've constructed in the Xingu area. I stay with the Kikuru and the Kikuru Indians and the Kalapalo Indians. And, they're just... Over time, they just come up with great ways. So, for example, when we were staying in the jungle, in hammocks, our conditions were kind of miserable and we were bitten by the bugs. But when we stayed with the Indians and their settlements, they have these beautiful houses that are constructed. They're made almost like of a thatch-like material. And the bugs are kept out and they're very cool inside. So I was always very happy when I was staying with them.
Yeah. Let's take one more call and then we're going to wrap it up here. So I hope our listener will be brief. Line one, Urbana, hi.
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 I actually read that book, Exploration Fawcett, about 15 years ago.
Oh, right.
And I just found it accidentally, too, walking around in the stacks. I kind of remember, I think it was in that book, there was a story about an inn where they had a spider that would do in guests from time to time. Do you remember that?
You know, you're testing my memory. I've read the book many, many times, and I don't remember that offhand, but it doesn't mean it's not there because I'm somewhat senile.
Well, you were talking about poisons and stuff, and I just always wondered if that story was true, if they really had spiders doing people in like
well,
that.
Well, it's you know, they certainly have, yeah, there are spiders that are poisonous. There are many of the animals in the Amazon are poisonous. For example, there's even a frog, which is only about the size of a coin, which has in it enough toxins actually to kill 100 people. And some of the snakes, like the pit vipers and the coral snake, are extremely poisonous. And if you are unfortunate enough to come upon them or step upon them, they will kill, you know, their poisons will kill you.
Whew. On that note, we will leave it. We're out of time. David Grand, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
David Grand is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He is the author of The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. The book is published by Doubleday.
And you've been listening to an archived edition of The Afternoon Magazine Today, an interview first broadcast in March, on March 13th. Celeste returns live tomorrow, and the topic will be customer service. Emily Yellen will be Celeste's guest. Emily's a writer, and the book they'll be talking about is Your Call Is, and in quote, in parentheses, Not That, end of parentheses, Important to Us, Customer Service and What It Reveals About Our World and Our Lives. Customer Service, the topic on tomorrow afternoon's Afternoon Magazine, following the 106 news from NPR. So we hope you'll join us then. Coming up on The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock, honeybee colonies in rural Germany have been dying out. So too have German beekeepers who tend to be elderly. But now younger Germans are tending bees in the city. The buzz about urban beekeeping in Germany and, of course, the latest on President Obama's overseas diplomacy coming up on The World at 3 o'clock this afternoon here on WILL. The time is 1:51, and settlement prices are in on the commodity markets and the Mercantile Exchange. And let's get the highs and lows and settlements from the commodity markets. And here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Jay. Let's take a look at those numbers in Chicago and Kansas City as they finished on this Monday afternoon in April with snow on the ground in Champaign County. Futures in the wheat pit in Chicago finished 6.5 cents lower. The high price today at 572 and three quarters, the low at $5.53. A settlement price there at $5.57, 6.5 cents lower for that May wheat contract. July at 584.5 top, bottom at 65, settlement price at $5.69, down 6.75. And September wheat, $6.07 the high, the low at 590.75. Settlement price there at 594.25, down 6.25. December futures, 630, the high, the low at 12.75. December wheat settled 616.75, down 5.75. From the March contract, 6 cents the loss today. $6.42 the high, the low at 626.75. Settlement price down 6 at 631 for the March 2010 contract in the soft red winter wheat pit in Chicago. They trade hard red winter wheat in Kansas City. The nearby May there finished 4.5 cents lower at $6.03 on its settlement price. In the harvest month hard red July contract at 613.75, down 4 cents in Kansas City. Back in Chicago now for the corn pit. May futures a penny lower, rather a penny higher for the day. 407.25 the high, the low at 399.75. The settlement price in the green up 1 cent at $4.05 a bushel for the May corn futures. July 417.25 the high, the low at 410. Settlement price at 415.75, up a penny. September at 426 top, bottom at 420.25. Settlement price at 424.75, a penny and a quarter higher. And December futures, 438, the high, the low at 30.5. Settlement price at 436.75, up 1.25. May corn, 449, the high, the low at 443.25. And the settlement price at 448, up a penny and a quarter. And the July contract for next year, 461.5, up 1.5 cents on the day. May oat futures, 203 at the top, the bottom at $1.96.5. Settlement price up $2, or rather up at $2 even, a penny higher for the day. In July, oats, 212.75 the high, the low at 206.5. Settlement price there, 209.25, 3/4 of a cent higher. From the soy complex, May beans settled like this, $10.09 the high for the day. The low at $9.86.25, settlement price at $9.94, a penny and a half lower. July futures, 10.08.75 the high, the low at $9.85.25, settlement price $9.93.5, down 1.75. And the August soybeans, $9.87.75 the top, the bottom at 64.75, settlement price at $9.71, down 5.75. September futures, $9.53 the high, the low at 31.25. Settlement price at $9.37, 9.25 lower on the day. And November beans, $9.30 the high, the low at $9.03. Settlement price at $9.12, 11.25 lower. The January 2010 contract, 10.5 cents lower today, $9.38.5 the high, the low at 13. Settlement price for that January soybean contract at $9.21.5, down 10.5 cents. May bean meal, $3.10.90 the high, the low at $3.04.30. Settlement price at $3.06.40, up 40 cents. July bean meal futures, $3.08.10 the high, the low at $301.10, and a settlement price at $3.03.10, a dime higher for the day. May bean oil, $35.68 the high, the low at $34.77. Settlement price at $34.99, down 33. And July, $35.94 the high, the low at $35.03. July soybean oil, 35.26, down 32 at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock, which is about 11 minutes away now. We'll talk during the closing market report with Kurt Kimmel. He's the senior grains analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois, and will help us take a complete look at what's been happening in the world of agricultural futures, including the livestock market, by the way, in Chicago at the CME Group, the nearby April live cattle today. At a high price of $86.60, a low at $85.60 with a settlement price at $86.52.5, 47.5 cents higher. June futures, $84.45 the high, the low at $83.60. A settlement there at $84.37.5, up 20 cents in the August contract, and $85.10 top, bottom at $84.40. Settlement price at $85.07.5, 27.5 higher. October live cattle futures, 88.85, the high, the low at 88.15. Settlement price at 88.70, 17.5 cents higher. April feeders for the day, 96.10, the high, the low at 95.10. Settlement price at 95.95, up 55. And the May futures, 97.50, the high, the low at 96.25, settlement price at 97.45, 75 cents higher. August contract in the feeder cattle, 99.75, the high, the low at 98.45, a settlement price at 99.60, up 85 cents. And the September futures, $100.22.5, the high, the low at 99.20, settlement price at $100.20, up 50 cents. April lean hog futures today, $60.25 the high, the low at 59.70, settlement price at 59.72.5, down 55 cents. May futures, 73.20 the high, the low at 72.55, a settlement price at 72.70, $1.20 lower. June lean hog futures, 90 cents lower today, 73.80 the high, the low at 72.70, settlement price at 72.75, down 90 cents. And the July contract, 74.55, the high, the low at 73.80. Settled at 73.82.5, 45 cents lower. Frozen pork bellies, $89.82.5, the high, the low at 87.20. Settlement price, 89.80, 97.5 cents higher. July bellies, 88.40, the high, the low at $86. Settlement price at 86.55, up 90 cents. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Todd Gleason, and we'll be back at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time with the closing market report. Be sure to stay with us for that. If you'd like to hear any of our ag programming, you can always do that at willag.org. That's willag.org. One of the great things there are the USDA numbers from the latest reports. You can go check them out. Just scroll halfway down the page and hit USDA. Recapping what happened in Chicago at the Board of Trade, futures finished like this in the corn pit, a penny to penny and a quarter higher. Beans were down 1.5 to 9.25 cents, actually 11.25 in the new November contract. And the wheat futures for the day down just about 5 to 6 cents on the afternoon.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Let's take a look at what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like. This comes from our own meteorologist, Daniel Pounder. He says a freeze warning is in effect from 10 o'clock tonight until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, both of those central time, of course, for most of central and southern Indiana, as well as most of southern Illinois. The forecast for the rest of the afternoon says in the northeastern parts of Indiana, periods of snow showers with an additional inch of possible snow will come by the morning. Elsewhere, cloudy, windy, and cold with occasional snow showers and flurries. Highs will range from 36 in the south to 36 in the north, rather, to 42 in the south. And tonight should be cloudy, breezy, and cold with occasional snow flurries across the two-state region. Lows will range from 26 in the north to 31 in the south. Tomorrow in the northeastern part of Indiana, mostly cloudy, a few flurries. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy, breezy, and cold. Highs will range tomorrow from 42 in the north to 50 in the south. The extended forecast says some unusually cold air will cause freezing temperatures throughout the Midwest and the Deep South both tonight and Tuesday night. The active weather pattern will remain in place through the next 1 to 2 weeks. Temps, says Mr. Pounder, are forecast to move above average once we get through this weekend, and that'll help drying rates as we head into the middle of April. There's no indication, though, of any substantial or long-lasting drying period for those fields out there that farmers are worried about getting into We're going to have to get some drier and warmer weather in place, he says, or we're going to have a very late planting system to have to deal with. That all from our own meteorologist, Daniel Pounder. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 in Urbana. In just about 1 minute, we'll join National Public Radio for their news from Washington, D.C. It's the top of the hour.